Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives. And this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's broadcast brings you Dr. Noam Chomsky, America's preeminent social activist. More on Dr. Chomsky in just a couple of minutes. At this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. He's an award-winning author of 32 books and a two-time Fulbright Scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia. His books include Queen Pins, Notorious Women Gangsters of the Modern Era, and Sergeant Smack, The Legendary Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin, and his Band of Brothers. He's also the producer of three award-winning documentaries, including the just-released Frank Matthews story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Ron is also the consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You could go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Get out there and buy his books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Also, be sure to visit his website at www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, which happens to be my hometown as well, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out next year. And this summer, he'll be publishing another book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Always a good promo. We really appreciate that. Thank you very much. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat is thrilled and delighted to announce the appearance of Dr. Noam Chomsky, one of the world's most famous activists. Noam Chomsky will discuss U.S. foreign policy, human rights, and international crime. By the 1980s, Noam Chomsky had become both the most distinguished figure of American linguistics and one of the most influential critics of American foreign policy. Mr. Chomsky is said to be the most frequently cited person alive and one of the 8 most frequently cited authors of all time. It's going to be a timely and fascinating broadcast where you all have a front row seat to the wisdom of a true American icon. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one. Now, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received, I'd like to thank our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. We're averaging over 130,000 listeners now every week, and it's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making this show possible. Like I said many times, Ronnie, Internet radio is a place to be. It's great to be recognized, and it proves we're right on track. Now, this is first mailbag of the week. This one is from Elizabeth of Las Vegas, Nevada, who writes, "Your show with Anthony Bruno 2 weeks ago about Richard Kuklinski was one of your best. Even though Kuklinski's wife didn't know about her husband's secret life of a cold-blooded contract killer, she knew he was a dangerous person because he beat her up, and more than once. Just goes to show you battered women are scared to death to report to the police their beatings by their husbands. Who knows? If she would have turned him in after the first domestic attack, he might have been caught earlier. Any remarks to our letter?
Yeah, that was a great point by one of our listeners. We should have explored that more with our guest, Anthony Brutto, who wrote the great book, Iceman, on that. But Anthony claimed that he didn't know nothing about Kuklinski and his murders, and he did over 100 of them, contract murders for the mafia, as well as for his own demented pleasure. So that was a really good point, and if we get Anthony on again, we'll explore that point.
Absolutely. A very fascinating letter, and thanks for that very, very much to our writer. Well, Ronnie, I hear you going up to New York City, Big Apple, to the Museum of American Gangster on April 11th to premiere your new documentary titled Frank Matthews' Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. Tell our listeners about that.
Right. We're going to be up in New York, in the Big Apple. We just had a screening in Durham at the Haytai Heritage Center, and it went extremely well. So we invite any listeners in the New York area to attend this gathering, and they could contact us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. And I should also alert our listeners to the fact that we'll be on the Chit Chat Cafe show, which follows us, and on April 5th, which is next Thursday, to the talk with Lisa and Nancy. I don't know what they want to talk about. Do you, Willie? Because they haven't mentioned anything, so maybe we're going to get ambushed.
Well, you know, I listened to the show. It's a fun show. I'm looking forward to talking about.
Yeah, it's one of the two or three most popular shows on Artists First.
Absolutely.
We're delighted to be on the air with them.
That's for sure.
Go ahead, Willie.
Well, I'll tell you, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present a rap sheet part of the program. A rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item. Dateline, March 26th, Toronto, Canada. Ontario's top court legalizes brothels in the Canadian province. Hey, Ronnie, the Court of Appeal from Ontario has swept aside some of the country's anti-prostitution laws, saying they place unconstitutional restrictions on prostitutes' ability to protect themselves. The landmark decision means sex workers will be able to hire drivers, bodyguards, and support staff and work indoors in organized brothels or body houses, while exploitation by pimps remains illegal. Quite the ruling, Ronnie. What's your comment?
Yeah, bravo for our native land, right? I think that's a great ruling. Sex workers are finally becoming citizens of Canada. You know, we call it the oldest profession in the world, right? They are workers, and like workers in other professions, you know, they'll have rights. And if their bosses, in this case pimps, abuse them, they'll still be, you know, prosecuted by the law. I should also add that prostitution is the oldest prohibition in the world as well. So hopefully, maybe we can learn something from this example that could be applied to the war on drugs, which, of course, you know, is the biggest prohibition right now going around.
Absolutely. Well, they need protection, and let's face it, it's the oldest profession ever, and of course, it'll safeguard
right.
Their...
Right. One of the sex workers said, finally, we're citizens of Canada.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, now, just before we get on with our featured guest, Dr. Noam Chomsky, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is the preeminent professor and social activist, Dr. Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky is said to be America's greatest intellectual. His massive body of work includes over 100 books and has for decades exposed the lies of the power elite and the myths they perpetrate. Dr. Chomsky has done this despite all but being ignored by the commercial media. He is America's most prescient critic of unregulated capitalism and globalization. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Dr. Noam Chomsky.
Glad to be with you.
Well, we must have referred to you as an activist several times. Is that the term you use to describe yourself?
Yeah, that's a fair enough term.
Right.
Among other things. Yeah.
Right, and among other things, how would you describe yourself?
Just a person who does what he can in the various areas of interest and concern that ranges from scholarly work to teaching to writing to giving talks to involvement in demonstrations, organization, quite a range of things.
Right. You are really well known, but still some people don't know you. I mentioned to a friend of mine that you were going to be on the show, and he asked who was Noam Chomsky. So I think we should get some background on you so people can understand you better. Could you give us a little background about yourself, about growing up, and how you eased into the activist life?
Well, I actually started in the activist life as a child. Long before I ever heard of the professional academic fields that I've been involved in. As a child, I grew up in the Depression, the 1930s. Early childhood memories are people coming to the door, selling rags, security officers smashing up women on strikes, textile strikes. A lot of my own parents had teaching jobs, so we lived okay. But a lot of my relatives were unemployed, working class, very lively. Intellectually active and politically active environment, despite the penury, and I just became, even as a child, very much interested in the events that were happening in the United States and also abroad. Actually, I was very concerned about the rise of fascism in Europe. It looked like a horrendous threat, and indeed it was. Actually, the first article that I remember writing, and I can date it quite precisely, was in February 1939, right after the fall of Barcelona to Franco. It was an article about the spread of fascism over Europe and what that portended. And from then, I just went on to other things. I was very much involved as a teenager in what was then called Zionist activities. The same activities are now called anti-Zionist. This was in parts of what was then the Zionist movement that were opposed to establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, were calling for Arab-Jewish cooperation in a binational community. That, as I say, was part of the Zionist movement at the time. It's considered anti-Zionist today. I still think it's a good idea.
Right.
And it just went on from there.
Right. Well, you were a precocious child, and you could have probably chose a lot of professions. Why did you enter the linguistic field? What attracted you to that?
Well, like most things in life, it was kind of accidental. I hated high school. I was in an academic, college-oriented high school. It was extremely disciplined and boring. I did okay, got all A's, that sort of thing. But I just couldn't stand it. And college looked exciting. Read the catalog, a lot of interesting courses. I was pretty excited. I went to the local college. There was no thought of living away from home at the time. I was a working student. But after a couple of months, I found it was just an overgrown high school, and I was thinking of dropping out. I was a 16-year-old kid. Didn't see much point going on. And I happened to meet, through political connections, a man who was, though I didn't know it at the time, was the leading theoretical linguist in the country, Zelig Harris. We had political interests in common. I was very much attracted to a lot of his ideas and his thinking. And he kind of convinced me to start taking his graduate courses, get back into college. And I did, and then he suggested other graduate courses in other fields, mathematics, philosophy, and kind of got interested in them. So I never really had an undergraduate education, a formal one.
Right.
But it sort of worked.
Right. It's amazing you joined MIT in 1955, and it's amazing to see the two careers develop, your role as a so-called social activist and your role as an academic. Was it easy to balance that? You know, I come from an academic background myself. I was a university professor for about 20 years,
yeah.
And I know it's hard, you know, to do things outside of academia, because it's, you know, academia can be so time-consuming if you take it seriously.
It's hard, but not impossible. I mean, I don't think I have a lot of talents, but one talent I have that I know a lot of my friends don't have is that I can easily compartmentalize. So I can be working on a technical, right now, for example, I'm in the middle of working on a technical paper, highly technical paper, and I can do it, you know, getting to it maybe an hour a day, and meanwhile doing and turning to other things, political activities and so on, and it doesn't seem to interfere. So if you can sort of, you know, handle that style of life, then you can carry it off.
Right. Willie and I both agree you should write a book on time management.
No, I don't know anything about it. Just do it.
Maybe you'll end up on Dr. Phil, because it's really amazing to read your background. But, you know, is there a connection between your academic life and your political views, or somehow they overlap some way?
I'm often asked that, and enough so that occasionally I've written about it. There's a sort of an abstract connection. And in fact, if you go back to the Enlightenment, you know, 17th and 18th century, the connection was actually drawn. It's not a deductive connection, like you can't deduce a position about politics from what you know about language, or conversely. But there's a kind of similarity at the core. In both domains, there is, or at least should be, recognition that there's something crucial about human nature is a kind of a drive for independence, creativity, searching, challenging authority, the most elementary aspect of language, which was, you know, discussed extensively from the 17th century, is it has a kind of creative aspect to it. So human language capacity, and this seems to be uniquely human, allows us to do what we're now doing, to produce new expressions, expressing new thoughts, maybe never expressed before in the history of the world. Others similarly endowed understand them, recognize them to be things they could have said themselves if they'd thought of it. And this goes without bounds. It's unlimited, infinite. And it's independent of external circumstances, or even, as far as we know, internal conditions. So it has a kind of core creativity to it. That's the central part of, say, Cartesian philosophy and its descendants.
Right.
And it reflects itself in the... with regard to social and political life as well. So the early the foundations of classical liberalism, and later more libertarian offshoots like much of the anarchist movement, the sources of it were in a conception of human nature that assumed that there's a kind of an instinct for freedom and for creativity, and that hierarchical and oppressive institutions that limit or constrain that freedom have a heavy burden of proof to meet. And if they can't demonstrate their legitimacy, they ought to be dismantled.
Right.
So that's you find this in Rousseau and Wilhelm von Humboldt, one of the founders of classical liberalism, and so on. And that kind of connection, I think, is real, though we should recognize that it's tenuous. There's no proofs. It's just a common perspective.
Right. I remember some of those names from my political theory class I took in college a long time ago. Mm. But, you know, in this sweep of your background, we're giving a very brief overview of it. We have to mention the Vietnam War, because by 1965, 10 years after you joined the MIT faculty, you were actively involved in organizing tax resistance and refusing to pay taxes. How did the Vietnam War shape your views of the world and U.S. and the U.S.?
Well, we should bear in mind that we are now, right this minute, in fact, failing to commemorate the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's launching of the war, a war of aggression against South Vietnam. Just 50 years ago, Kennedy sent the U.S. Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam, authorized napalm.
That's very interesting because I was watching CBS News before we came on here, and they talked about the Vietnam Memorial but didn't mention that.
No, nobody, there's no commemoration,
right?
No memory. It was much worse than I just described in those two sentences. But, and then, of course, it grew into a massive attack. It ended up killing maybe 4 million Indochinese, destroying four countries. The worst, by far the worst act of aggression in the post-World War II period.
Right.
But you're right. Nobody mentions it because nobody even paid any attention.
Right.
It took years before it was possible to... before an organized, active opposition developed, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, as late as 1966, that's about 5 years after the war started, by that time, South Vietnam was practically destroyed. As late as 1966 in Boston, where I live, which is quite a liberal city, we could barely have public demonstrations. I mean, even if they were, say, in a church, it would be attacked by counter-demonstrators, students.
Yeah, sorry, Dr. Chomsky. Ron, I've got a quick question that's relevant. In 1962, you wrote that there was a crisis, one of the most dangerous crises in history, where this Russian sub, this renegade captain, had to be stopped, or he did stop. It could have started a nuclear war, one of the most dangerous times in history. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, that's a person who ought to be a hero, Vladimir Danchev.
How many people know that? That'd be interesting.
Well, what happened was that Kennedy authorized an embargo around Cuba, and it was enforced by the U.S. Navy, and Russian ships were approaching the line of the embargo, where the enforcement line was, and there were submarines, and the submarines, nobody knew it at the time, but it turned out that they had missiles with nuclear warheads, and a couple of the submarines were attacked by depth bombs from American destroyers. Now, they didn't have much communication with anything, and they assumed that a war was on. Two of the submarine captains authorized a nuclear strike, an attack with their nuclear-tipped missiles. But Russian provisions for use of nuclear weapons decided that required that three commanders agree, and the third one didn't agree. So, yes, we were spared what could have escalated into a major nuclear war.
Did we learn anything from the Vietnam War other than not to allow the journalists too close to the theater of action?
Well, who is we? Well, the population, I think, learned something from it. We should learned a lot of people, at least, learned... and internalized a kind of significant opposition to aggression and violence.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's interesting to compare the Vietnam War with the invasion of Iraq 50 years later. The invasion of Iraq was, I think, the first time in the history of Western imperialism that an invasion was... massively protested before it was even officially launched.
Mm-hmm.
Very different from the early days of the Vietnam War, in fact, even after a couple of years.
But it didn't make any difference. The Bush administration still went ahead.
Well, I don't, you know, that's what people say, but I'm not entirely convinced. I think it made a difference. It made a difference in restraining the use of force.
Mm-hmm.
So was awful enough in Iraq, but it never even came close to what the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, or later the Nixon administration, did in Indochina. There were no saturation bombings by B-52. There was no chemical warfare to destroy crops. They didn't drive millions of people into, off the land into what amounted to concentration camps and urban slums and so on.
Right.
Plenty fled, but they weren't driven out.
Right. You've written that the U.S. has never ended its efforts to win the war in Vietnam, and this is an extension of what the U.S. has been trying to do since 1945, which is namely establish a world imperial economy dominated by U.S. capital. Can you give an example of how this operates?
Today?
Yes.
Yeah, well, take a look at the headlines. The big issue that dominates the headlines as far as these issues are concerned is what's called the threat of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
There's extremely severe sanctions on Iran, which in fact are a blockade, which mm-hmm. is in effect a declaration of war.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly, there are a couple of interesting things to bring up about that. The sanctions are the U.S. and Europe. That's called the international community.
Mm-hmm.
But just ask yourself who participates.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not Russia and China, and not India, which rejects the sanctions, and not Turkey, which is increasing its commerce and trade with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
What about the Arab world right nearby?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we read is that the Arabs support the U.S. actions, but that's a reference to the Arab dictators. When you look at the Arab population, which is very heavily polled by Western and other polls, turns out that almost none of them think that Iran is a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 5% in the latest poll.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what they see as a threat is Israel and the United States. In fact, populations are so opposed to U.S. policies that a majority think the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons. Now, they don't like Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the hostility between Arabs and Persians, it goes back millennia, but they still think they'd be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons to counter the United States. So in short, if you look around the world, there's virtually very little support for this, the U.S. and Europe.
Right.
Second question to raise is, what exactly is the threat of Iran?
Mm-hmm.
When you read the dire warnings of this horrendous threat that we can't live with, obviously, one thing that's kind of missing is a clear description of what the threat is. Well, in fact, there is a clear description.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's an authoritative answer, which is never cited.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence, and it's in exactly the place where you'd expect it to be. Every year, the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies provide a review to Congress of the global security situation, and of course they have a long discussion of Iran,
mm-hmm.
and you can look there, you can pick it up on the internet, a few people, maybe a few others write about it. They make it very clear what the threat of Iran is. They stress it is not a military threat.
Mm-hmm.
Iran has very low military spending, even by the standards of the region, obviously minuscule as compared with the U.S. It has little capacity to deploy force.
Mm-hmm.
It has a military strategy which is defensive, designed to deter a direct invasion long enough for diplomacy to set in. They point out that if, that's a big if, Iran is developing nuclear weapons capability, which nobody knows, but if they're doing it, they say that would be part of their deterrent strategy,
mm-hmm.
to defend themselves from a potential U.S. and Israeli attack.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the threat.
Mm-hmm.
The threat is that they might be a deterrent to the free exercise of force by the United States and its allies. I mean, there are other charges that's charged that Iran is destabilizing the region. And if you look at what that means, it means they're trying to extend their influence, political, commercial, cultural, into neighboring countries.
Right.
and Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, you know, these are countries under U.S. military occupation that Iran is trying to extend its influence into them is an interesting kind of charge. And there are some other claims, but they don't fare much better than these. The core issue is deterrence. And similarly, if you look at China, you know, the other main concern, it's kind of similar. There's much worry about the Chinese military buildup and how that might threaten, you know, the United States.
Right.
Well, there's military buildup, and like Iran, China, the Chinese government is hardly admirable. Both governments are a threat to their own population. That's a different issue. But the Chinese military threat, which is described accurately, is that they're intending, they're trying to gain control over the waters that are off the coast of China, you know, extending a couple hundred kilometers. These are the sea lanes that are used for Chinese commerce to the Middle East, to the West, everywhere else, and they'd like to control them. And the U.S. doesn't accept that. Mm-hmm. That's called the denial of the U.S. Dominance of the Pacific, in fact, all oceans. So it's the same sort of thing. It's there's no discussion of, say, Chinese threat to the Caribbean. It's the Chinese threat to gain control of their own waters, the ones near them. And if you're intending to rule the world, basically, well, you know, such threats are unacceptable.
Let's take a break, Willie, and we'll get back with this fascinating discussion with Dr. Noam Chomsky.
Absolutely. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Reb. Our very special guest this evening is Dr. Noam Chomsky, one of the world's most well-known social activists. Now back with Ron and Dr. Noam Chomsky.
Thank you, Willie. And we're back with Dr. Noam Chomsky. Dr. Chomsky, what's your latest book for our listeners out there if they want to purchase some of your books?
Well, two of them just came out. One is a linguistics book. It's called The Science of Language. The other is a political book. It's called Making the Future. That's a phrase that's borrowed from the Bush administration, who described their role as making the future while others just describe it. And a bunch of collection of essays on that.
Right. And you can go to www.chomsky.info for a complete list of Dr. Chomsky's books. And Dr. Chomsky is on Facebook and Twitter, which is kind of interesting.
It's without my knowledge.
I know Willie told me about that. And I ran across an article in the Salon. I don't know if you're familiar with that article by Nathan Jurgensen, who took you to task. This was an article in October 25, 2011, for describing the social media as superficial and shallow. Say it ain't so, Dr. Chomsky. You know, given the media and its impact, you know, you look at the Middle East, you look at Occupy Wall Street, do you really believe that it's superficial and shallow?
Well, actually, what I said is that interchange over social media, say on Twitter, is necessarily superficial and shallow.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so much you can say in a couple hundred characters. Mm-hmm. But the social media themselves have been an extremely valuable device for bringing people together, organizing them, creating communities of common interest and common action. And they have played a very significant role in things like Occupy or you know, the Egyptian and Tunisian uprisings and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no criticism of that. It's just the comments. I didn't read the article you're talking about, but I kind of vaguely remember the comments were about the a concern, which I do have, that when discussion and communication is reduced to a couple of sentences,
mm-hmm.
it has a cheapening effect. Actually, I can see it in the email that I receive, to tell you the truth. And in fact, what I said might have been a reaction to that,
right.
Even an answer to a question about it.
Mm-hmm.
I get a ton of email,
mm-hmm.
Hundreds of letters every day, and try to answer them.
Right.
And a lot of them are serious, considered, and so on. But I've noticed over past months that a lot of email is just one line. It's been pointed out to me that's probably Twitter.
Right. Yeah.
Well, how could that be anything but superficial?
Yeah. Ronnie, I've got a quick question.
Go ahead, please.
Dr. Chomsky. We're going to shift our attention to the Western Hemisphere, Dr. Chomsky. As you know, Cuba has been in the news with the Pope's visit. The U.S. embargo against Cuba is now nearly 60 years old. The hardships that the Cuban people have endured have been, really harsh. Can you comment on the human rights violations these prohibitions and restrictions have had over the last six decades? And the second part of the question is, what would you like to see happen in a post-Fidel and Raul Castro Cuba?
Within Cuba? Well,
yeah.
Within Cuba,
right.
I know what I'd like to see, but it's up to the Cubans.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the embargo is concerned, that's up to us. This is a very brutal policy. It's been it's had a very harsh effects on Cuban life. It's almost totally unilateral. Now, just take a look at the votes at the United Nations. Every year, the General Assembly has a vote on it. Now, the United States alone, Israel, and maybe the Marshall Islands, it's been condemned as illegal by just about every relevant international organization. It's opposed by the majority of the population here. So for about, I think ever since polls have been taken, since the 70s, a considerable majority of the population has been in favor of normalizing relations with Cuba. Rather interestingly, very substantial parts of the business world also are in favor of it. Substantial ones, energy industries, pharmaceuticals, agribusiness. Now, these are powerful industries which usually have which are very influential typically in shaping policy. But in this case, they've been overruled, just as the population and the world have been overruled. That indicates that there's a powerful state interest in punishing Cuba. The pretexts that are given are almost laughable. Up until 1989, the pretext was it's a dangerous security risk. It's an offshoot of the Soviet Union. Okay, Soviet Union collapsed. The policies not only continued, they were made harsher.
Mm-hmm.
And instantly there was a shift to a new pretext. It's our love of democracy and human rights, which all you have to do is look around Latin America and see the countries that we support or elsewhere in the world. And you have to laugh. I mean, whatever one says about repression in Cuba,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't begin to come close to the that of the major countries, to the major recipients of military and economic aid from the United States.
Right.
So that can't be the answer. And that does raise an interesting question. Why the savagery?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we actually have some answers to that. We're lucky to live in a very free and open society, more so than any other in the world. So we have extensive access to internal documents, declassified internal documents that reveal the thinking among state planners. And in the case of Cuba, there's a very rich array. They've been declassified for years. Going back now to the Kennedy and Johnson administration, Kennedy administration primarily, but then the policies just continued. The concern was what was called successful defiance of U.S. policies going back to the Monroe Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
No Russians, U.S. policies going back to the Monroe Doctrine. Well, Monroe Doctrine, 1823,
mm-hmm.
Declared that the United States was basically going to dominate the hemisphere, didn't put it in those words, but that was amounted to. Of course, it couldn't be implemented then. The British were much too powerful. The British were the big enemy. They were the deterrent. But it was recognized that sooner or later, Britain's power would decline, U.S. power would increase, and Cuba, which was a major concern, Cuba would fall into our hands by the laws of political gravitation, just as an apple falls from the tree. Now, that was John Quincy Adams, the great grand strategist, you know, the intellectual author of Manifest Destiny. And that's what happened through the 19th century. Britain declined. The United States gained more power. By 1898, Cuba was revolting. The Cubans had revolted against Spain, and it happened a number of times. But in 1898, they were coming pretty close to liberating themselves. The United States intervened. Here, it's called the liberation of Cuba. But if you look back to it, it's the prevention of the liberation of Cuba. The U.S. basically took it over and turned it into essentially a virtual colony. And that's the way it stayed until 1959. Of course, U.S. Influence and power extended over most of the rest of the hemisphere, too. But Cuba was, let's keep to Cuba. In 1959, Cuba did liberate itself from the dictatorship that the U.S. had been backing. For a very brief period, maybe a few months, the U.S. hesitated about how to react, but very quickly, this is Eisenhower now, the U.S. adopted policies, essentially the policy of trying to overthrow the government and restore the previous status quo, colonial status quo. By late 1959, the U.S. planes were bombing Cuba. By early 1960, there was a formal decision internal to the Eisenhower administration to overthrow the government. At that point, Kennedy came in. Kennedy was going to, he wanted to shift policy to closer concern for Latin America. He had a Latin American advisory group that was headed by this well-known American historian, Arthur Schlesinger, liberal historian who was Kennedy's Latin American advisor. And the group, as Kennedy was coming in, they presented advice to the incoming president. Schlesinger summarized it, and what they argued was that the threat of Cuba, I'm quoting it now, is the spread of the Castro idea of taking matters into your own hands, which might have considerable appeal in other countries of the region where the mass of the population is suffering from similar kinds of oppression. Well, that can't be accepted. What's sometimes called the threat of a good example. You can't allow that to continue. Then came the Bay of Pigs invasion. When that failed, the United States immediately turned to not only an embargo, the crushing embargo that you described, but also to a massive terror war. It's a very serious one. Thousands of Cubans were killed. All kinds of terror. It was Operation Mongoose was the main name of it. Its goal was to bring the terrors of the earth to Cuba. Those are the words of Arthur Schlesinger again in his semi-official biography of Robert Kennedy, who was in charge of the operation. In fact, it was his prime responsibility. Well, that Operation Mongoose was intended to lead to an invasion in October 1962. Well, that's when the Cuban Missile Crisis broke out. Cuba did receive missiles from the Soviet Union, and that led to the missile crisis. Robert McNamara, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, conceded that if he'd been a Cuban, he would have, a Cuban planner, he would have assumed an invasion's coming and that they needed some defense. Well, that almost led to a nuclear war. Not just the case we mentioned before, but right toward the end, it was really touch and go. After the missile crisis was over, the policies continued. Terror, embargo, goes right to the present.
Well, let's take another break, and we'll go into the last segment, and we'll talk about a couple of domestic issues relating to crime with Dr. Noam Chomsky. Willie?
You bet. What a fascinating interview. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb. Our very special guest this evening is Dr. Noam Chomsky. Now back to Ron and Dr. Chomsky for the remainder of the program.
Thank you, Willie. And I wanted you to get your views on the prison industrial complex. Today we have 1 in 4 black men have spent time in jail at some point in their life, and by 2020, that figure is estimated to be 1 in 2, and I got this from a recent conference I attended. So in other words, there's more and more black men, young black men, being put in jail. What do these figures say about our society and where
Quite
it's going, what's become?
Quite a lot. First of all, if you go back maybe 35 years or so, the incarceration rate in the United States was pretty much like other industrial societies, you know, not
right.
off the chart. Now it's about five to ten times as high as other industrial societies. That's not because of an increase in crime. In fact, the crime rates back then, you know, around 1980, were pretty much like other societies, slightly toward the high end, but not off the spectrum. And there's been no increase, in fact, in many ways decline. The major driver of this massive incarceration is what you mentioned, the drug war.
Right.
The drug war was initiated by Nixon. I mean, it goes way back, but the current phase was initiated by Nixon,
right.
Sharply expanded by Reagan, on through Clinton. And that's, I don't remember the exact numbers, but a very high percentage of the people in prison are there for victimless crimes.
Right. Marijuana possession.
Possession, yeah.
Right.
And they're overwhelmingly black, secondarily Hispanic. And that's not because they use drugs more.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, their drug use is approximately like whites. Well, what's it all about?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, some other things happened in the 1970s. In the 1970s, the U.S. economy underwent a pretty sharp shift throughout the whole of American history, you know, from
mm-hmm.
colonial times on. This had been a growing, developing, later industrializing society. Not, you know, it's not a steady rise. There's
mm-hmm.
regression and so on, but that was the trajectory. Changed in the 1970s. And then the 50s and the 60s were, in fact, the period of highest growth in American history. And it was pretty egalitarian growth. The poorer sectors did about as well as the wealthier ones. But that changed very specifically, explicitly in the 1970s by design. There was, there's a recent publication of the Economic Policy Institute, which is one of the main sources of regular, reliable data on the economy. It's called Failure by Design.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do in the monograph, they review the period from late 70s up till today and point out that from a socioeconomic point of view, it's been a serious failure for most of the population. It's meant stagnation or even decline. But they also point out that it's a class-based failure.
Mm-hmm.
So for a small part of the population, the top 1%, or even the top 0.1%, it's a fabulous success. And they've become super rich. And they also point out it is by design. There were other choices all along the way.
Mm-hmm.
The design was to shift the economy in two ways. One is by offshoring of production.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you produce in, production goes on, but in northern Mexico or, you know, southwest China or Vietnam or something like that, it's very profitable for the manufacturers and the owners. But it's very harmful to American workers, of course. So one part was offshoring of production, and linked to that was the radical growth in financial institutions. So if you go back to the big growth period, 50s and 60s, banks were doing what banks are supposed to do in a in an economy like ours, kind of state capitalist economy. So a bank would take, say, your bank account and lend it to somebody who wanted to build a house or start a business or send a kid to college or whatever it might be. Well, that's what banks are supposed to do. In the early 70s, it started to change radically. First of all, it was an enormous growth of financial institutions, huge. By now, they're the dominant part of the economy. And they engaged in different activities, speculation, complex financial instruments, things like the, last decade, the subprime mortgages, derivatives, breaking them up into tranches, complex financial manipulations. Along with this went a deregulation. Well, during the 50s and the 60s, the New Deal regulatory apparatus was in place, and there were no financial crises. Starting in the 80s, we started having financial crises, big bank bailouts, saving and loans crash, most recently the current financial crash. And these are the product of deregulation and enormous growth of complex financial manipulations. And they're exacerbated by what is commonly described as a government insurance policy. It's called too big to fail. So if a big bank tanks, instead of going bankrupt, taxpayer comes in and bails it out. And that just extends, intensifies the risky behavior, of course. Well, what did this mean for the population? It meant that for the workforce, they're losing the opportunities that they had in the 50s and the 60s. You know, when, say, a working person could get a job in an automobile factory and get a pretty decent wages and buy a house, and, you know, live in a nice community, send a kid to college, that sort of thing. That ended pretty much in the 70s. Not totally, but it sharply changed. Well, who gets hurt by that? The latest people to enter into the workforce, who happen to be overwhelmingly black, up until, you know, blacks didn't really, I should say we're reliving something that happened after the Civil War. During the Civil War and immediately afterwards, formally slaves were freed, and they in fact were freed for about 10 years. But by 1877, there was a North-South Compact, which essentially gave the slave and former slave-owning states the power to pretty much re-enslave the former slave population. The method that it was done was criminalization.
Right.
They basically criminalized black life. So, you know, a black man standing on a street corner could be arrested for vagrancy or and so on. And pretty soon they had a large part of the black male population in jail, and they became a workforce, kind of a slave labor force. In fact, a good part of the American Industrial Revolution was based on mining steel factories and others in southern states, which relied heavily on this workforce. I mean, we are familiar with the images of the chain gangs. That was basically putting blacks back to work in the agriculture.
We still have them now. They've reinstituted a lot.
Well, okay, that went on until the Second World War, pretty much. Second World War, free labor was needed for war industry. Then came the 50s and the 60s, you know, the big growth period. So African Americans were able to begin to enter the mainstream society. Well, 70s and 80s, that's pretty much reversed. So what do you do with them? Toss them back in jail.
Dr. Chomsky, we're almost out of time. It's a fascinating discussion. I have one last question, and unfortunately we're going to need a soundbite from you. What's your feeling about the future of America? We've got so many problems, and there's so many much rancor. What do you think? Do you think this country is going to survive itself?
Will the society survive?
Yeah, right. Yes, right.
Pretty much up to younger people. like it's always been. It's in their hands. You know, I'm pushing 84. I'm not going to do much about it. But people have a lot of opportunities. I mean, I think a lot has been achieved. We tend to forget that. It's a much more free and civilized society than it was, say, when I was 30 years old, 50 years ago. Women's rights have extended enormously, despite the drug war and the criminalization and so on. Minority rights have improved. There's much more activism. There's more concern about the use of force and violence, opposition to it. There are now, for the first time, serious environmental concerns, as there should have been a long time ago. And there's just a lot more freedom and opportunity. I mean, plenty of problems, too. You know, don't want to underestimate them. So, for example, one of the 1960s were a kind of a liberating period, and they caused a lot of concern in elite circles. There was an effort to quote what was said to overcome the failure of the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. Actually, that's coming from the liberal side of the spectrum. And many measures have been taken to try to reverse that. One of them is student debt. So by now, student debt is about close to $1 trillion. It's, I think, multiplied by about 900% in the last 30, 35 years. And that traps students. If you're, you get out of college with a huge debt, that cuts back your choices a lot. Now, the reason for the debt, I don't think you can, I mean, it's claimed that it's an economic problem, but I think that's very unconvincing. I mean, you look at other countries, from poor to rich, countries like Mexico, poor country right next to us, to rich countries like Germany and Finland, they maintain either negligible or zero tuition. In fact, we did too.
Dr. Chomsky, I'm going to have to jump in here. We're almost out of time, and we want to invite you back on the show because we barely touched what we wanted to talk about, but we really have appreciate having you on the show. It's been quite an honor, and we hope to see you again soon.
Hope so.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Chomsky.
Okay, good talk.
Okay, thank you then.
Yep.
Thank you, Dr. Chomsky. All the best.
Right, Willie, we'll just sign off.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for April the 5th. Our guests will be journalists Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson, authors of Portrait of a Monster. They'll discuss the infamous Joran van der Sloot and the Natalie Holloway mystery. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. We'll hope you enjoy Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive page on the Artist First Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we would like to thank you for listening to the broadcast. In the meantime, we welcome all your emails at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Well, Ronnie, thanks very much, and we welcome everybody next week where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Good night, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.